Welcome to Moments with Marianne. This is your host, Marianne Pastana. Are you dealing with the feelings of fear, shame, and regret that come with unrelenting challenges or addictions? Stephen Washington is here today to share with us his new book, Recovering You: Soul Care and Mindful Movement for Overcoming Addictions. So let's welcome to the show, Stephen Washington.
Thank you, Marianne. So good to be here with you.
Oh, it's always an honor to spend time with you. We had so much fun talking last year. I knew we had to have another talk. And so I wanted, before we kind of dive into everything, you know, Recovering You, I mean, what a great topic. What a great title for your book. What inspired that?
What inspired me to write the book and really come up with the title, because I feel like the title really accurately describes this process, this experience of recovery. When we are in active addiction, we lose parts of ourselves, right? It's a trade-off in terms of we engage in these addictive behaviors and thoughts and ways of being, and we sacrifice a part of ourselves, a deep, deep part of ourselves. And the process of recovery is just this recovering and discovering lost parts of yourselves. And also, at least in my experience, parts of myself that I wasn't even fully aware of, I have the opportunity now in recovery, in this really the second life, to discover more about myself. And I think that's all of our jobs while we're on this planet, is to know and understand ourselves as well or as best as we can, and also to love ourselves as we are, as much as we can.
I've heard some talk recently, especially within this new year, that most people are addicted to something. And so I find that interesting, because when I think of phone addictions and, you know, being addicted to devices or drugs or alcohol or food or you name it, you know, even could be work in many ways. Yeah. It seems that we all are striving to move through these addictions to really come back around to ourselves.
Yeah, I believe that we all have things that we depend upon in life. And I think what makes something, an addiction, something that challenges us in that unique way, is when that thing that we're dependent upon starts to impact the quality of our life. That despite the negative consequences that we may feel and experience as a result of our dependency on this thing, we continue to engage in it. So, like you said, there are so many ways that we can essentially check out. Because I look at my addictions, the things that I have experienced with in my life that I became dependent upon almost as much as I depend upon air to breathe, those things began to negatively impact my life. At one point, they were a coping mechanism that helped me to be in the world. And I was able to balance all that came with it. And then there comes a point when it's difficult or impossible to balance that. And that's when you cross the line and into that territory of addiction. And I look at that as an incredible opportunity to then begin to get help that you need, and then also to make different choices to create a life that's different from the one that you've been living.
So you've been sober from drug and alcohol for about 20 years now, right?
Yeah, a little over 20 years now.
What was your journey like?
It's a very good question. And, you know, I'm really grateful to be in recovery and sober for as long as I have. But I have to say that it's really not even about how much time I've had between this moment and my last drink. It's really about the day and what I do today to help me to maintain my sobriety and this path of wellness. Tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I come from a very dysfunctional family. There was a lot of trauma in my family, a lot of dysfunction. The way that people dealt with the trauma in their life was to drink. do drugs, release explosive anger, amongst other things. And for me, being the sensitive child that I was, it was very difficult for me to be in that environment. And when you have, when you're in an environment like that, where the adults are caught up in their own serious troubles, they're not available to the child to help the child to grow and develop the way that they should. And so I found myself at a very young age doing things to help me self-soothe and self-regulate, whether it was biting my nails or rocking myself to sleep or picking my nose or all kinds of things that I tried to, that I was intuitively led to in order to help me feel better being in the skin that I was in on this planet. And so by the time I turned 15, I believe, I had my first drink of beer. And by the time that moment arrived, I was so ready for it because I literally had been holding on for years. I felt like I was holding my breath. And when I had that drink, I finally felt like I could breathe, like I could exhale. And that's not to say that leading up to that moment, I didn't have things that brought me some semblance of peace. I found dance. I found the arts before that. And that somehow magically would transport me out of my circumstances, at least in my mind and in my body, where I was able to find some relief. But there was nothing like that first drink. And the what I felt that first time made such an impression on me and was so impactful that I knew I wanted to do it again. And that I chased that feeling, that experience over and over again, really for the rest of my drinking and drug using days. And for many years, I drank and I used drugs and smoke cigarettes with not a tremendous amount of consequences. Of course, there was the time when I was drinking and using drugs with friends. I think it may have even been New Year's Eve. And I just had so much that I literally for a few minutes lost sight. Like I couldn't see. My eyes were wide open and I couldn't see my friends standing right in front of me. And to a normal person having an experience like that, they would have cause to pause and perhaps question their behavior. I did for maybe a few minutes, and then I was off to the races again as soon as I possibly could. And then, and so things pretty much carried on like that. And I was able to pretty much manage it all and have a successful dance career and even had a few relationships, but it was definitely eating me up inside. And it, by the time I had my, by the time a really important and incredible career event happened, which was me joining the cast of Disney's The Lion King, by the time that happened, I was in a relationship that I did not know how to walk away from. I didn't know how to use my voice. I didn't know what I wanted in my life. And that caused me a lot of stress and anxiety. And then I had this incredible job that had been offered to me and I accepted. That was incredibly demanding and very stressful. And me being the perfectionist I am, I didn't know how to healthily navigate it. So what I did, and what I always did up to that point, was to drink and do drugs and to smoke. And so I did that. And that's around that time is when I started to feel the consequences. That relationship imploded. And I did that single-handedly. And then the relationships, the friendships, the work relationships that I had with colleagues were strained because of my behavior and my using. Had an incredible job that paid me so well, but I would waste my money on drugs and alcohol, and just life became incredibly unmanageable. Eventually, I became desperate enough to ask for help. I'll never forget. It was a night I was by myself in my apartment. I had been up all night. And I just looked at myself in the mirror and I couldn't recognize the person looking back at me. And I just said the word, help. Help me. And that was the first time I'd ever done that. And that was when the cracks started to form within me and the light was able to get into my heart. And I would say 6 months to a year later, that help that I asked for in that moment came. And it came through a therapist that I had that called me out on my behavior. It came through that experience forcing me to look a little deeper at myself and to reach out to a friend who was in recovery, who always wore sobriety like a beautiful garment. Like he wore it so well that it made it look so appealing. It just made it look like, oh my gosh, if I could have a little bit of what he has, that would be incredible. And at that moment, I was ready to do that. I was ready to ask for his help, and I was ready to do anything that he would have told me to do. So he took me to my first recovery meeting, my first 12-step meeting. And when I walked through the door with him and sat down, I was a little bit nervous, but overall, I felt more relieved. And I felt relieved because I felt like I didn't have to fight and struggle anymore. I felt like I could breathe again. And I felt like I was in a room full of people who totally understood exactly what I'd been through, what I was going through in that moment. And they gave me a glimmer of hope as to what's to come, the potential of what's to come. So I just kept going back and I kept going back and I kept going back. And then days turned into weeks, weeks turned into months, and months turned into years. And then before I know it, it's 20 years later. And life has been incredible in sobriety. And it's also been very challenging. And one of the greatest gifts that I've received in recovery is just learning how to live life on life's terms and not have to resort to drinking or drugging or smoking because I feel uncomfortable with the moment, because I'm having difficulty accepting a moment, or because those are the things that I would drink over all the time. And so I don't have to do that today. And that's incredibly empowering and freeing. And that experience is something that I've never forgotten, and I carry it with me today. And one of the things that I want to mention as well is that about 10 years into sobriety, I went back to school for Chinese medicine, and it was an incredibly stressful time. I'd worked so hard to get there only to realize that that wasn't the place I was supposed to be. And the experience brought up a lot of old wounds, like shame and not enoughness and amongst other things. And I really was on the edge of being completely overwhelmed, on the edge of a breakdown, and certainly on the edge of a relapse. And one of the things that helped me was Qigong, when I was introduced to it in the curriculum at the school. And I'll never forget it, because Marianne, literally moments before walking into that classroom that day, and really all the classrooms during that semester, especially at the beginning, just a few minutes earlier, I was in my car crying because I was so riddled with fear and anxiety and worry and panic. But I would go into that class, that Qigong class, and start to sort of settle into what the teacher was saying. And then when we began the physical practice, the medicine started to work through my body and it would calm me down. It would bring me into the present moment. It would calm me down. It would allow me to zoom out a bit. So I got a bigger perspective that it wasn't what was happening to me, wasn't something that was happening to me like a punishment. It was all happening for me. And it gave me the opportunity to understand that and know that whatever I decided to do from that moment forth, I was going to be okay. And I knew from that moment on that Qigong was going to be a part of my life, and that it was going to help me live a healthier life. It was going to help me help enhance my recovery. And I knew that I really wanted to share it with other people. And that's what eventually led me to right here, right now with you, having written that book and having this conversation.
Well, I found your book to be one of the most impactful reads for me personally. And I'm sure your ears were burning because I was talking about you earlier. And and it's just interesting because you bring an approach that I feel is really heart-centered. And a lot of times people, I think they need that when they start to get into this, you know, recovery kind of mode.
Absolutely. I wrote this book for anyone, no matter where they are on their recovery journey, whether there's someone who is already in recovery and is well on their way. I also wrote it for the person who is getting ready to get ready, because that's also a part of the process too. None of this transformation happens overnight. And I also wrote the book for people who have been in recovery for a long time and they are looking for new ways to take care of themselves, because at the heart of the book, it's about self-care. And self-care takes time, it takes consistency, it takes creativity, and self-care makes us resilient and better able to manage stress. And I know that because I had such a difficult time managing my stress and my energy and just being in the world, that my addictions helped me to just feel okay. So what I want to do with this book is give people other tools and other suggestions that can help them to feel okay in their bodies, feel okay in the world, feel okay in their life, and then build a life that's more conscious and joyous and free.
In your book, you talk about the connection between freedom and recovery. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I think about active addiction, I think about how limiting that is. I think about how the life of a person in the throes of addiction becomes quite small. Even if it looks as though they're living a big life on the outside, what's happening on the inside can often be very different. And I think that's one of the things that's characteristic about addiction, that there's a lot of loneliness, there's a lot of isolation. And you can be in a crowded room with people and still feel lonely and isolated. And the process of entering recovery and being in recovery is just the opposite of that, because we tap into the energy of a community, of a group. And there's so much to be gained by having loving, nurturing, caring connections with people. And that gives us the ability to step out into life a bit more, knowing that you have the support that you need. And when you can do that, there is an incredible sense of freedom. There's an incredible sense of freedom that there's nothing that you can't do, that there's nowhere that you can't go. Because you have community, I know for me, recovery has brought me a spiritual life that I had no idea that I was going to gain from this experience. And when you are spiritually fit, and I'm not talking about religion, but just spirituality, when you're spiritually fit, there's no place you can't go. There's no one you can't talk to. There aren't any limits. So the limits that were placed upon us before start to melt away. And so that's what I mean by this freedom that we find in recovery.
So when you talk about soul care, what does that mean?
Soul care. I think soul care is anything that we do that tends to the health and the well-being of our body and our mind and our spirit. All the practices in the book, whether they are the self-massage or the breathing exercises or the meditation or the self-reflection, the community building, everything in the book tends to the needs of the soul. And yes, there's quite a focus on movement, mindful movement in the book, which tends to the needs of the body, but it's important to remember that it's the body that houses the soul. And it houses every aspect of us. And anything, any time that we invest energy and our hearts into anything to take care of ourselves, we are benefiting our soul.
When we look at self-care practices and soul care practices, you have so many great examples and practices in the book that people can start to use. What is one that you can share with us right now?
I always like to think about the breath. I always think about how important the breath is. And the breath is, it's life. We can go some time without eating or drinking, but we can't go very long without breathing. And it's something that's available to us 24 hours a day. So a simple practice is just taking some deep breaths. You can even just place one of your hands on your lower belly and then take a deep breath in through your nose. And as you inhale, just allow your abdomen to expand. And then as you exhale out through your nose, allow your abdomen to soften. So again, as you inhale, the belly button moves away from your spine. And as you exhale, the belly button pulls inward towards your spine. So being a witness to the rising and the falling of your breath. As you inhale, see if you can stretch your inhale, perhaps to 5 counts. And then at the end of your inhale, just notice that little pause. And then exhale the breath out. And as you exhale, see if you can stretch that exhale to at least 5 seconds long. And then at the end of that exhale, just notice that little pause there. And then inhale again. So just stopping the busyness of life just for a few minutes to pay attention to your breath. And we can tell a lot about how we're feeling by how we're breathing. And in some cases, how we're not breathing, because many of us, and you might identify with this, and many of us walk through life holding our breath many times in a day, holding our breath, which creates more tension in the body, which creates more discomfort in the body. And so just taking time to really tune into the breath as a tool of self-regulation, it goes a long way. And it's the very least we can do for ourselves in terms of self-care.
So some of the benefits of doing this slow, deep breathing is things like it helps our nervous system stop releasing cortisol.
It does. It shifts us from fight, flight, freeze to it activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which is responsible for rest, digest, restorative, this sort of restorative way of being. And when we are able to do that, to activate the parasympathetic nervous system, it turns on the natural healing within the body. So it's very important. And there are just countless other benefits as well. The movement of the diaphragm gives the internal organs an incredible massage and also helps to improve digestion, which is important because when we are stressed it affects our digestion. Very often people feel stressed and then they become constipated, or they suddenly have diarrhea. There are just so many things that stress, how stress impacts the body. So these are just little things that we can do to help regulate and help us to, again, positively impact the central nervous system.
In your book, you talk about mindful movement. What do you mean by that?
Well, mindful movement is moving your body with awareness, paying attention to your body as it moves, paying attention to the sensations you feel as you move, bring awareness to how you're breathing while you're moving, and then also being aware of your thoughts as you move. There are so many ways that we can move our body. A lot of the movements and forms of movement and exercise that we do can be done in a very mindless way, where we don't think about what we're doing. We just sort of going through the motions. But mindful movement is an opportunity to pay attention to what you're doing as you're doing it, and also to bring your awareness to the present moment, to bring a level of presence to the moment, to what you're doing. And that has the incredible ability to, A, help us to self-regulate. It also helps us to focus our mind and concentrate. And then also it has the ability to just make us feel better, because when we move our bodies, it helps to release the feel-good hormones in the body, the endorphins and such, that give us a good feeling in our body and a more positive outlook in our minds.
Well, thank you for going over that. I think it's how you've interwoven all these aspects really help people to look at whatever their addictions are and move through them, because it's something that can be moved through.
Absolutely.
And that's encouraging.
Yeah. And can I add one more thing, Marianne?
Please
I also, movement is a very important part of this work. And the way that I use movement in the book is at the end of each chapter, there is a Qigong movement that I invite the reader to put down the book, or to before they go on to the next task in their day, to just do this movement practice, because it will help them to integrate the teachings within the chapter, help to integrate the information into the body and the mind. And I think that that's such an important part of healing. And it really is the center, not only of the book, but also the center of my life and what I do. And that's one of the reasons why I created my membership community, the SWE Studio, because I wanted to create a wellness community that is accessible and affordable for people. It's a place where I teach Pilates and Qigong. It's a fusion class that I created. And along with that, I teach meditation as well as dance and laughter medicine, all to just help people to live healthier, more conscious and joyous lives. And I know just from firsthand experience how important movement is. So I know what my mission is, and I take great joy in doing the work that I do.
You're definitely very good at it. I've been watching your videos and being part of your community. I think it's real important for just everyone, because it kind of gives us this baseline of how to start our day.
Yeah, and create self-care practices. Like I said, self-care is so important. And many of us don't do self-care well. It's important that we do things, as far as self-care is concerned, that we enjoy doing. And I try to give people so many different options so that within that, they can find something that they enjoy doing. And then they can certainly add to whatever it is that I offer. But I just want to help people to create that kind of structure for themselves in their lives, because I just know how important it is.
In your book, you talk about how fear and addiction go hand in hand. I'd love for you to share about that with us.
Yeah, fear is such a powerful and pervasive emotion. It's something that we all experience. We all feel at some point. And fear is one of those emotions that it's useful. There's when we feel fearful, it gives us information because we're in some way interpreting our environment. So perhaps it's something that's going to help us to survive. But what happens so often is that we become fearful of things, or thoughts come into our minds that create an emotion and creates a physical response. And it's not always because we're in a situation that is truly dangerous for us. So what I explore in the book is that fear is something that we don't have to be afraid of. Also, fear is an emotion that we can work through. I think sometimes when people feel fear, they get stuck. And I try to offer ideas and suggestions to help people work through their fears. One of the things that I'll never forget is when I first entered recovery and started working with a sponsor, and part of working through the steps was to make a fears list. And I talk about this in the book, where you just make a list of all your fears. And there's something incredibly empowering about writing down your fears and then seeing them on paper. Because something shifts when you see it all on paper, just in terms of your awareness of it. And you're able, at least for me, I was able to be a little bit more objective about it. So that was one tool that he gave me. And then also to take a fear that I have, like a specific fear, and to just play it through in my mind. Thinking about a fear of, for instance, abandonment. Like I in my life, I've had fears around abandonment. And I would allow myself to think about, well, if I were to be abandoned by someone, what would that look like? What would that feel like? Would I be okay if this person was no longer a part of my life or in the role that they're in right now? And part of the fear is underneath it all, somewhere in there is this fear that I'm not going to be okay if I'm abandoned. But the evidence of my life tells me something different. Because when I look at my life in its totality thus far, I've always been okay. Whether as people come and go in life, and that's what happens in life, people come and go, I've always been okay. So just taking the time to sort through that, and it's very, very helpful to do that with another person as well. We're able to shift just our relationship to some of our fears. And what I know about fear as well is that it's one of those emotions that can just inspire us to self-medicate, because we don't want to feel our fears. We don't want to feel our feelings. We don't want to face our fears. And so we drink, or we smoke, or we do drugs, or we do whatever our addictive behavior is, just to check out and just sort of kick that can down the road a little bit further. But unfortunately, and fortunately, when the dust settles, that thing that we're afraid of is still there. We've just delayed the inevitable. And it's just so important to, if we're ever to heal from addiction, we have to get better at managing our fears. There's just no question about it. No question about it. So it was important for me to talk about in the book, and also have a conversation with my friend Bill about it. I quote him in the book, and we just talk about our own experiences with it and just things that people can do, different ways for them to think about fear and to shift their awareness around it and their consciousness.
I love how in your book you talk about how sharing your fears really helps to diminish them in many ways.
Yeah, a problem shared is a problem halved, is what I heard when I first started going to meetings. And I feel like that's so true. It's so true. When you keep it inside, it just festers.
What do you think is one of the number one emotions that keep people stuck in recovery?
I think shame is a real important one. I talk about that as well in the book. And that's that feeling that we have that there's just something inherently wrong with us and that there's nothing we can do about it. That feeling that we're just unworthy. And that's an important emotion to look at and to work through, because if you don't find a way to address the shame in your life, and it will just continue to wreak havoc in your life and push you more and more towards those addictive behaviors, just as a way of checking out and to self-medicate. I love what my friend Keith said in the book, that he wasn't able to really get a hold of his drinking and start recovering until he worked with someone, a professional, on the shame he was feeling. Because he had tried so many things, so many different ways, so many times before then, but it never dealt with the shame. And once he finally dealt with the shame, that's when he was able to make headway. And I love what Brené Brown says about shame, that shame needs three things to survive: silence, secrecy, and judgment. And when you're able to share your shame with someone who you trust and who you know can hold space for you in the shame, and also who won't judge you, it's incredibly healing. And when you are met by someone who doesn't judge you because of the shame that you feel, that has the power to get you to eventually learn to look to yourself with more compassion, less judgment, and more kindness.
It seems a lot of families teach their children, and maybe because they've learned this as well, that, you know, the keeping things quiet and secretive, and so coming out of that is a real kind of a life change.
Absolutely. You're only as sick as your secrets is another phrase that I learned when I first got sober. And that's so true. The truth shall set you free. And just being honest, really working towards just being rigorously honest in your life with yourself and with other people is very freeing. It gives everyone who does it an opportunity at a new life and a new way of being, a new way of existing and living.
I often hear people talk about triggers, that being something that that we have to plan for. So what are some coping strategies for triggers, and what would some of these triggers look like?
Well, triggers can be different things for different people. There are different kinds of triggers. There are environmental triggers. There's also triggers related to like relationships, connections with people. And then there's also triggers that we feel just around things. So people, places, and things can be very triggering. And how it feels to be triggered is different for everyone. You might feel, when you feel triggered, you might have an emotional response. It might make you angry, or it might make you sad or frustrated, or another emotion. It might physiologically make your heart beat a little bit faster, or you might feel like a tightening in your belly, or maybe you start to sweat, or your mind begins to race. So just so many different ways that one can experience it. But it's important to get a better understanding of how you experience feeling triggered. And there are different things that can trigger you. I know for me, some of the things that triggered me in addiction were certain people. There are certain people in my life that I associated using with. Initially, I just couldn't be around them when I was trying to get sober. I couldn't be around them. And so that's one of the changes I had to make. There were certain neighborhoods that were very triggering for me. So I couldn't go to certain neighborhoods because I had such history with them, different places that I used to frequent, disturbing memories of being drunk or high and things that may have happened during that time in certain areas. And so I would avoid those places. I would take a different route to get from point A to point B. That was rarely affected. I would take different train lines so that I wouldn't have to go through certain neighborhoods. It would take me a little bit longer to get to where I was going, but at least I managed to be able to do it sober. That was really important. People can feel triggered, not even just with those very difficult things that I just described. I think about the people that I know who would feel triggered when it was payday, when suddenly they were going to have more money in their pocket than they had previously. And then that would inspire them to want to use that money to drink or to buy drugs, because you have money and you feel this sort of sense of euphoria and you just want to increase that feeling. So there are just so many different things that ways that we can experience that. Some of the other tools that I used to use and still do when I'm feeling triggered is to call someone, tell someone about it. I used to have and I still do, I have a list of phone numbers in my phone of people who are part of my recovery circle, and even people outside of that, where if I'm feeling triggered, I can reach out to any one of those people and share with them what's going on. And just taking the time to make the phone call is really impactful, but also the time you'll spend leaving a message or having a conversation with them has the ability to just shift where you are, where you're feeling really triggered, to a place where you're able to be a bit more calm. Because also when you're triggered, that part of your brain that is connected to that fight, flight, freeze gets activated. And when that part of your brain is activated, it's really hard to reason, to use logic. And so if we can just find some way to regulate ourselves within that moment of feeling triggered, then we're more likely to make better decisions around it. So those are just some of the things to think about when it comes to this discussion about triggers and what they are and how to become more sensitive to what triggers you, and then some of the actions you can take to move past them and move through them without harming yourself further.
I was very impressed with a chapter that talks about building social support and being able to have that in place. You offer so many practical and useful tips that people can use. And it's not, it's something that would really empower their lives.
Yeah. And absolutely. Thank you for that. And also, I know how difficult it is for people to reach out and to ask for help, because at the core of social support and having it and building that in your life, it requires asking for help, reaching out to other people. And if you've lived a life that's, or if you're living a period of your life where you are isolated, it's a jump in order to build a social support network. But it's so important. And as I talk about in the book, it's you can start small. Start small. Like I love what my friend Ileana in the book says, how she would go to meetings and she was advised to go to a meeting and sit in the front and to raise her hand, even if she had nothing to share, just to say, my name is Ileana and I'm an alcoholic and I don't know what else to say. I'm just trying to reach out, and that's it. Because then what happened, at least for her, and that's, I have the same similar experience, is that people then come up to you later on and introduce themselves, give you their phone number, invite you out for coffee, we'll walk you to the train to talk, things like that to help you feel less alone. And that's monumental. That's monumental. And we can't underestimate the power of that. We're social creatures in our nature. And addiction disrupts that sort of natural way of being that we have. And addiction and trauma disturbs that. And so recovery, I think, is a way of acknowledging that, but moving through that and beyond that in order to get the help and the healing that we need.
I would say also that we're in this interesting time in our history where people have had to isolate because of everything that's gone on with the pandemic. And it seems that we are in an area at time where people are reporting more addictions or having problems with addictions. Do you feel that that has to really tie into that loneliness aspect?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think that we've all been impacted by the last few years in ways that none of us had ever really imagined. And it's been very difficult to navigate for many of us. It's an interesting time, I could say, for myself, because for me, I am by nature somewhat of an introverted person with some extroverted tendencies. And there was an element of what we experienced in the pandemic that felt very familiar to me. And I was able to find some comfort in it. Although I wasn't completely alone. I'm married, I have a husband, we have two cats, we have our own little family and community. But I know that not everyone had that same experience. And I think there were people who were very, very triggered by the whole experience and did not know what to do with it and did not know how to process it, did not have the life skills to help them through it. And a great gift for me during that time too was that my 12-step meetings were at once in actual physical spaces, and then they all moved to virtual spaces like Zoom. And so I was able to connect with people in that way from the comfort of my home and the safety of my home. And so that was a really important way to step out of that isolation and loneliness that I at times felt during the pandemic. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, I am so lucky to be a recovering addict and alcoholic because I have this community to tap into. That's such a gift. That's like, I wish everyone had that. I wish everyone had that. And there are ways for everyone to tap into that kind of energy and that kind of community support. And it doesn't have to be a 12-step meeting. It can be another support group that will help you feel less alone and help give you the community and connection that you need in order to build a life beyond where you are at the moment.
You have this whole chapter on gratitude. Hmm. And in your book, you talk about gratitude break. I'd love for you to share about what that is with us and how that works.
Gratitude is such an important tool. Such an important tool to utilize in life, just taking a moment every day at some point in the day to be grateful for something in your life. I usually would have a list of 3 to 5 things that I'm grateful for. And there's something about being grateful that helps shift us. It changes our brain. It changes the wiring of our brain. And it's something, again, that we all have access to. And you just have to carve out time for it in your day. And it doesn't take much time in order to do it. My friend Kristen in the book talks about how her first sponsor required her, when they were working together, to write a gratitude list every morning, to start off the day every morning. And that's a great time to do it because it helps to set yourself up to view your life and your day in a certain way through a lens of gratitude, looking at, oh, I have this in my life. I have this in my life. I'm so grateful that I have this in my life. This, having this in my life, gives me A, B, and C. Those types of things, as opposed to focusing more on what you don't have, what's missing. Oh, I don't have this, or I don't have that, or so-and-so has this, but I don't have that. Why don't I have that? And you can already just hear and feel, and just in the way that I'm describing it, a shift in energy. One is more hopeful and optimistic and positive, and the other one is more pessimistic and lacking of hope and heavy. So taking a gratitude break has the ability to just shift our consciousness, shift our way of being. And when we can focus more on what we're grateful for, we're more able, more likely to be able to create more things in life to be grateful for. And when we are when we have gratitude, it helps us to be more optimistic, and it helps us to move forward and create goals and achieve those goals because we're living a life with gratitude.
Well, Stephen, we can actually talk for hours. I just love your energy and your book, Recovering You. Where can our listeners connect with you and learn more about your work?
Yeah, StephenWashingtonExperience.com is my website. And on my website, you'll see all the things that I do, all the work that I do and what I've created and am sharing with the world. You'll find links to where you can buy my book, Recovering You. You'll also learn more about my membership community, the SWE Studio. Just for $22 a month, you can create a life full of more health, wealth, and well-being and balance. For the price of what, 4 Starbucks drinks a month, you can do something really, really great for your body, mind, and spirit. You can also find on my website all the different links to my social media platforms and my social media profiles on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, as well as Medium and TikTok. And that's basically where you can find me. That's where I'll be.
You're everywhere. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with us here today.
Thank you, Marianne. I'm so happy to be here with you, and it's always a pleasure to spend time with you.
Well, thank you, Stephen. We're going to pause here for a quick moment, and we'll be right back after this message. I'd like to thank Jason Eastwood at Guitarfulness for sharing his inspiring music and talent with us. His music is known worldwide for cultivating atmospheres of harmony, inner peace, and clarity. Visit Jason's website at guitarfulness.com. Join his newsletter, be part of his community, and download his music. Well, we're at the end of our time today. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in. You've been listening to Moments with Marianne, where we make every moment count.
In a single moment, your life can change. Moments with Marianne is a transformative hour that covers an endless array of topics with the best of the best. Her guests are leaders in their fields, ranging from inspirational authors, top industry leaders, and business and spiritual entrepreneurs. Each guest is gifted and a true visionary, a recognized leader in her own work, and while teaching others to develop, refocus, and grow, Marianne will bring the best guest and sometimes a special surprise. Don't miss this. You never know just which moment will change your life forever. Make sure to tune in and visit MomentsWithMarianne.com for more information.